This is a special edition of Mac Format This Week. An in-depth recap of Apple's latest product announcements from the Worldwide Developers Conference in San Francisco, California. Hello, everyone. I'm Brad Gibson. We've got tons of news and reaction from our team of experts, and all that's coming up shortly. But before that, let me remind you that in addition to our podcast and website, you can also subscribe to MacFormat Magazine. Each month, we bring you dozens of product reviews, tutorials, and features from a true team of experts. UK customers can subscribe to MacFormat by going to www.myfavoritemagazines.co.uk/MFC/2003 or by clicking now on the Enhanced Podcast link. With the resources of MacFormat Magazine, this is an extended edition of MacFormat This Week. One thing you can say about Apple, they're staying busy at one infinite loop. On the 8th of this month, Apple again used its Worldwide Developers Conference to debut a myriad of new products. Everything from new iPhones to new laptops, launched a new version of its Safari web browser, and put the finishing touches on its newest operating system, Snow Leopard, that will be in consumers' hands in September at a low price never before seen. With me to review the highs and lows of Apple's announcements is our resident experts, MacFormat Deputy Editor Chris Finn, and MacFormat This Week Associate Producer Misha Sakharopoulou. Guys, thanks for joining me for this recap. So much announced and something for everyone, really. No really big surprises that we weren't expecting, but a lot of smaller pieces of news regarding features of, say, a particular product. And let's begin with new notebooks, including a new version of the 15-inch MacBook Pro with a longer lasting battery. This new device will have a battery life of up to 7 hours, 2 hours longer than its predecessors. It also features a nicer display, an SD card slot in place of the former Express card slot, support up to 8 gigs of RAM. It's going to be available in speeds up to 3.06 gigahertz, 6 megabyte L2 cache, making it the fastest notebook that Apple has made to date. There's a 17-inch MacBook Pro refreshed to 2.8 gigs in terms of the processor. But really, the surprise is the addition in the MacBook Pro line of the 13-inch unibody aluminum MacBook. Speed bump there as well, now featuring an 8 gigs of RAM, 500 gig hard drive, option of a 256 gigabyte SSD drive. This is the real surprise here, Chris, and let me begin with you in terms of this addition of the 13-inch, isn't it?
That's right. Well, it kind of didn't make sense before when you had the aluminium unibody MacBooks along with the white polycarbonate MacBooks as well. It was a slightly awkward fit. But then again, I sort of feel that even now it's an awkward fit again. I feel like for the first time in a very, very long time, Apple has confused its product lines in a way that isn't useful for customers, because the MacBook Pro, or for the PowerBook as it used to be before, used to be for properly serious machines. But now, with it being included in the 13-inch MacBook Pro, the price has gone down slightly in the UK, the specs have gone up. It's a nice little machine, lots of power in a small portable package, but it's not really a pro machine. It's got integrated graphics, you know, good integrated graphics, but integrated nonetheless. And I think the buying decision just became an awful lot more complicated when you're looking at a MacBook Pro now than it used to be.
Misha, would you agree with that regarding the 13-inch?
Well, I'll come at it from the other angle, which is that there's a lot of pros who don't need the faster graphics card. And previously, you had to pay for that. If you wanted a 15-inch screen, which is not unreasonable, let's face it, like, you were automatically a pro user in Apple's mind. So I like the fact that now they've got an entry-level 15-inch MacBook Pro, which doesn't have the additional graphics, which makes it more on par with the 13-inch, you know, what is now the 13-inch MacBook Pro. So I think the line between, you know, pro and consumer is definitely being blurred a bit. Whether that makes the buying decision any more difficult, I don't really think that's the case. I think, you know, now you no longer have as big of a jump in price between the lower models and the higher models, which I think is just going to make a whole lot of consumers in the middle that much happier, because they don't have to choose between saving a bit of money and getting a machine that maybe doesn't have everything that they want, or spending a lot more money and getting more than they need.
And there's some nice stuff as well, because with the 13-inch MacBook Pro, the FireWire port makes a triumphant return. You get a FireWire 800 port on there as well. And we've seen Apple, I think, in my view, see sense in including a built-in SD card slot in the sides of the MacBook Pros rather than the Express card slot, although that remains in the 17-inch model, I think. And I think SD card is a much more sensible solution for most people who are using this as a... SD has become sort of de facto standard for flash memory cards now, and even low-end DSLRs are using it now. So that's a good step forward.
Well, that's actually the one change that I feel makes the 15-inch MacBook Pro less of a pro machine. It's true that SD cards are really popular and ubiquitous, but you can get Express Card Reader if that's what you wanted. And if you're a pro now, the only I.O. option you have, like fast I.O. option on the 15-inch MacBook Pro, is going to be FireWire 800. And if you price a FireWire 800 drive and enclosure, it's vastly more expensive than an eSATA drive or enclosure, which you could connect to the MacBook Pro if you bought an eSATA Express card.
Right.
So, you know, not only that, but it's also, I mean, it's faster, it's cheaper, they're easier to come by. So Apple's really sort of pinning pro users, pro MacBook, you know, users in this corner of saying the only storage options you're going to have now is FireWire 800.
I think if Misha and I have proved anything today, it's that we just don't know what to think yet about this lineup. It seems quite subtle, but there have been some quite big changes, and we'll be keen to. We're getting these models in from Apple shortly. We're keen to put them through their paces and see how well they perform. See how good, for example, the screen of that 13-inch MacBook Pro is, because that's one of the reasons I went for the 15-inch MacBook Pro when I bought my recent laptop, rather than the 13-inch MacBook, because the screen is so much better. So these little things, we'll have to wait and sort of put them through their paces, give them some tests and see how they fare before we make some final decisions. But initial impressions are, from my point of view, quite good. I think particularly with the 13-inch MacBook Pro, the price, as I say, has gone down from £929 to £899. The processor's gone up, it's got FireWire back, and it's got the illuminated keyboard that was previously reserved for the top-end models. But it's not a clear-cut case.
Right, right. I mean, but why now SD card slot? Only because of the pressure from the Windows world, which has had SD card slots for a long time and majority of their machines? I mean, that's just really confusing to me. Why now?
The honest answer is I don't know why now. It's been a bone of contention for me, and it's something I've mentioned often in reviews for a long time now, that Apple didn't include some sort of memory card readers in there. They're very useful for transporting storage. They're great for photographers in particular. The one point to make here in photography terms, obviously, is that the high-end or even medium-range DSLRs still these days are using compact flash. But the new breed of entry-level digital single-lens reflex cameras are using SD models, from Canon being obvious examples of that. So, you know, it's nice. All geeks always want more ports, and if there was the option for having an SD card slot as well as an Express card slot for that ultimate expandability, and I completely take Misha's point about, you know, adding eSATA or adding compact flash ports or adding extra I.O. ports through that. But if there's an option for both, great. There's not. And in a lot of cases, I think the SD card's going to prove more useful for a lot of customers. Was it Phil Schiller who said something about only 1% of people using that Express card slot as it stands? And that doesn't surprise me.
I think if Apple sold Express card like readers the way that they sell video adapters, which is to say that they sell about 10 different ones for around £20 each, I think if they just marketed the Express card slot better, they could actually make a lot of money. The way I couldn't stop thinking when they were going over the specs of the new MacBook Pros, whether Microsoft's I'm a PC advertisements affected them at all. Because if you look at these commercials, which I'm not sure whether they're airing in the UK or not, but in the US, these are commercials where you know, an average typical consumer goes into a store and is looking at very superficial specs. They say, oh, I want a 15-inch screen. And you can get PC laptop for $600 with a 15-inch screen, but you need to spend $2,000 for a Mac. So there's this perception of it being vastly more expensive. Similarly, you know, the most PC laptops do come with memory card readers. They do come with 4 gigabytes of RAM, which is stuff now that Apple's, you know, standardizing on, and they're bringing the prices down. And I couldn't help but think, you know, Microsoft's campaign now, they're going to sort of have to adjust all those ads, because a lot of the main points, which, like, let's face it, are not that compelling, have now been mitigated by these changes Apple's made.
I think that's a really valid point. I think what Apple's done in this latest refresh, the notebook line, is to make it a bit more granular, give you some more options, you know, make the jumps between models, or more importantly between lines, much less rigidly defined, you know, and for some people that will be useful. It's difficult to know, it's impossible in fact to say without being Apple or without being Microsoft whether those changes are as a direct reaction to what Microsoft is saying with those I'm a PC ads, or whether it's more a case of Apple sort of licking its finger, holding up to the wind and seeing what way consumers are trying to buy and sort of adjusting their sales, their marketing and their product lines to reflect those different new purchasing methods.
Right. And there is some evidence that those PC commercials playing in the United States are having a profound impact, negative impact on Apple, positive impact on Windows PC sales, especially laptops. So you wonder what kind of pressure that brought on Apple, if any, to add SD card and be more aggressive in pricing. We'll get to pricing in a minute. Let's hear right now from Senior VP of Worldwide Product Marketing, Phil Schiller, with some words about this new laptop line.
I'm really happy to show you first today a brand new version of the 15-inch MacBook Pro. Now, it's built on this unibody architecture that allows us to pack more things into a thin design than anyone else does. So built in is a revolutionary lithium polymer battery. We started this earlier in the year with a 17-inch MacBook Pro. This battery gives an amazing up to 7 hours of battery life. That's 2 hours longer than before, 40% greater battery life. Majority of notebook batteries in the market today get about 300 full recharge cycles before they start to have diminished ability to retain a charge. These new lithium polymer batteries of ours are over 3 times longer, over 1,000 recharge cycles. Yeah. So that means a typical notebook user will get about 5 years of life before they see diminished charge in that notebook battery. That's incredible, because that's longer than a typical notebook life. So most customers may never need to change the battery in their notebook because it will last that long. Unlike our competitors, who in that same time, often the customers will go through 3 batteries, not dispose of them properly, and it's just not good in the environment. So you get this incredible battery life, this long life battery, all in a design that's just as thin, just as light. When you open it up, the new 15-inch MacBook Pro has a gorgeous display. In fact, it's the nicest display we've ever put in a notebook. It has 60% greater color gamut, which means more vivid colors on the display. And as you go around the I/O side, you see there's all the I/O on the left-hand side. If you zoom in, you see something different this time. In place of the Express card slot, which was used by less than a single-digit percentage of our customers, there's a new SD card slot. But why an SD card slot? Well, most all our MacBook Pro customers have digital cameras today. And of course, you can plug it in with a USB cable, but customers really like the convenience of popping out the SD, and they've all standardized on SD now because of the speed and capacity they hold. And now you have the convenience of just popping it right in to the MacBook Pro and importing your photos right into iPhoto and Aperture and Photoshop, wherever you are.
And let's talk about pricing now that we mentioned just a few minutes ago. Apple's dropped the prices on the entire notebook line pretty substantially in some cases. The 13-inch MacBook Pro, the range is now $899 to £1,149. That's ink vat. The 15-inch model will range from $1,299 to $1,699, and the 17-inch model will now cost £1,849 ink vat. All the models are now shipping. We talked on this show the last time Apple did a laptop upgrade about the pricing and the fact that prices had gone up, the pound versus the dollar, because of the economy, and we complained about that. Now we see substantial price decreases both in the U.S. and the U.K. on these laptops, and you have to wonder why now. Chris, why now, do you think?
Difficult to say. I think if we look at the pricing, I don't think the changes are particularly dramatic, and I certainly haven't analyzed the prices properly between the old range and the new range. The one that did jump out at Ian, our reviews ed, was that the price for the 13 inches, we say, has gone down from the 929 for the unibody MacBook, as was before, to 899 for the unibody MacBook Pro 13-inch. So it's almost a like-for-like comparison there, and the price has actually gone down. It's impossible to say why the prices have changed. I don't think Apple ever really intends to take anyone for a ride or to rip anyone off. They set prices fairly, depending on what they can do. And I think we're just seeing the market setting the prices as it stands just now.
And let's move on to Snow Leopard now. We now know that Snow Leopard will ship in September. What we don't know is the exact UK pricing. It will sell for £83 or $129 with an upgrade for existing Leopard users available for $29 in the US. But we're not sure exactly yet what the pricing will be in the UK. And Chris, we believe it's going to be around £19, £25, right?
Yeah, maybe £19, £25. Depends how they translate the dollar across. But, you know, fair enough, I think.
Exactly. Apple Senior Vice President of Software Engineering Bertrand Serlet gave a demonstration of Snow Leopard and gave a few more hints of some of the features that will be coming.
The challenge that we set for ourselves is to build a better Leopard. So what does that mean? Three things. First, lots of refinements across board. Second, powerful new technologies. And third, exchange support. First, refinements. You know, macOS 10 is made up of a lot of projects, over 1,000 projects. And for Snow Leopard, we've decided to refine over 90% of all those projects. So let me give you some examples. The Finder. We actually love the way the Finder is in Snow Leopard. And so for Snow Leopard, we did not change it, at least the user interface. What we did do is rewrite it using our modern toolbox, Coco, so that we are better positioned for the future. There's lots of little benefits, lots of little touches that you'll start noticing once you, once you start using Snow Leopard. Next, the dock. In Leopard, we added a beautiful 3D rendering for the dock. But I don't know about you, but my desktop sometimes has a little more clutter. And we've had a feature for the longest time on how to deal with clutter. It's called Exposé. So what we did is we've built Exposé into the dock. The way it works is you just click and hold on an app tile, et voilà, you select the window you want. Next, installation. That's probably your first contact with Snow Leopard. And we've made it even faster, up to 45% faster. But maybe more importantly, after you install Snow Leopard, you actually recover some disk space. Over half the footprint of the OS, over 6 GB more space, thanks to technologies like file system compression.
So let's get into some of these right now, guys. Snow Leopard, new in September, will run faster than the current operating system, include updates to all of its apps. What really stands out for you, Misha?
Well, this is, I think, the operating system upgrade that really serious Mac users have been waiting for a few years. I mean, this is going to be able to, you know, substantially boost the performance across the board of everything, including the Finder, which has always just kind of lagged behind every other part of the OS, it seems. The other big thing that I liked is this new Dock Exposé feature. So Dock Exposé takes Exposé, which, of course, is the feature for finding, you know, Windows amidst all the clutter, and focuses it on just one application, which, for me, I've never used Exposé very much, simply because I feel it takes more time for me to pick one window out of 30 than it does to switch to an application because I usually know which application I'm using. So that's sort of intriguing to me. I think that might actually improve the performance of my workflow. Otherwise, I'm just looking forward to all the under-the-hood improvements. I mean, it seems like this is just going to be a faster, more reliable operating system, which is frankly all that I've really been looking for the last few years. There's not a lot of features in Leopard that I take advantage of and I'm glad are there that weren't in Tiger.
And Chris, what stands out for you?
Well, there's three things I'd like to pick out. Optimization is a big one, one that Misha touched on. We've got some really cool stuff here with parallel processing and using graphics card for more processing stuff. These things are very, very geeky, and we have to wait until the software developers are creating applications that take advantage of them. But the OpenCL stuff and the Grand Central Dispatch stuff that we've got coming in Snow Leopard should be brilliant, and it should really open up some really fast computing in the years to come. So that's one thing. Exchange support is another. So right in the operating system, Apple has licensed Exchange from Microsoft. Now, Exchange is the big sort of email, contacts, and calendaring server that Microsoft develops. It's actually a very good server, even for small businesses, never mind large multinational corporates. We use it here at Future Publishing, and it actually is very good. But at the moment, to get the best out of it, you have to use Microsoft Entourage. And I'm on record as saying I don't like Entourage. I think it's not a very good Mac application. But that's going to be built into the OS, so Mail, iCal, and Address Book will all use that information natively. And obviously, the same technology exists on the iPhone, so you've got everything sort of tying in together if you're working in a business with an Exchange server, so that's great. And the third thing, and this was something that I hadn't seen before that was really quite cool, is Chinese handwriting recognition built into multi-touch trackpads. So before, if you wanted to enter pictographic characters, you'd have to type it in phonetically using the QWERTY keyboard, and then the Mac would convert it into simplified or traditional Chinese. Now you can just draw the shapes on the multi-touch trackpad, and it will automatically detect those and refine them and then type them into your document for you. That sounds like a really cool little thing, and it really opens up the Mac to these other cultures as well.
To me, some of the really interesting things that came out in this demonstration at WWDC was Grand Central Dispatch and the 64-bit support. Now, we already knew that those were coming, but because of that 64-bit support, we're going to see some really big speed increases in a number of areas, and one of those is in Time Machine. We're going to 50% faster than Leopard in general use, a much quicker wake from sleep, shutdown when joining wireless networks. It's going to be really a lot faster overall, and now up to 45% faster than Leopard in the installation process. So the really big thing that I think the majority of consumers are going to see as the big difference in Snow Leopard is the speed differences in terms of installation and just general use. Would you agree with that, Chris?
I think speed is going to be a big, big thing. And even, in fact, we've seen it talking about using up 6 gigabytes of space less on the hard disk than Leopard. And that, I think, partly at least is going to be due to the fact that PowerPC support is dropped. And hopefully we'll talk about that in a sec. But one thing to pick out is I don't think these speed increases that you're talking about are necessarily related directly to the fact that it's 64-bit. 64-bit, all that means is that it can address... all that means in practical terms is it can address more than 4 gig of RAM at once. And those sort of changes, structural fundamental changes to how much RAM can be addressed at once, are less tied up with startup speed and sleep wake and that sort of stuff than are things like heavy duty image processing and video editing stuff that we'll see coming in further down the line as apps from third parties are optimized for 64-bit processors.
The really interesting thing that stood out for me in this keynote address is the fact that they really took so many more shots at Windows and Microsoft. Snow Leopard is going to beat Windows 7 on price and ship date, and they really took some major pot shots that we really have not seen before.
I think one thing that Microsoft hasn't done yet is they have not announced pricing yet for Windows 7. As most people know, Windows upgrades are usually orders of magnitude more expensive than Mac upgrades. I think Vista Ultimate's like $200 or $300. I think they're going to really give Microsoft a run for its money with the whole idea that Macs are more expensive. It'll be interesting to see whether Microsoft doesn't offer a similar discounted upgrade path for Windows Vista users, which may be why Apple's doing this for Snow Leopard.
Chris, £19, $29, whatever ends up being in the UK, an upgrade price that we've never seen Apple do before. Why do you think the reasoning behind this? Do you think that they're worried that the Snow Leopard is not going to sell that well because it really hasn't been the type of OS that, you know, we've talked about in the past that, you know, is glitzy and has all these new features? This time it seems to be more under the hood. Do you wonder if Apple is worried that it's not going to sell because of that?
Yeah, I would assume that was the reason. Obviously, I don't know, but I can't think of any reason why that wouldn't be true. I think if you're trying to sell, in the sort of marketing sense, if you're trying to convince people of the need or the desire to buy something, if you haven't got big, sexy feature to talk about, then you're going to have problems. And I think in the past, we've seen Apple selling the OS upgrades on the basis of the features. Do you remember in the past, we've seen, you know, it's like a whole new Mac for £99 because, you know, 300 new features, all this sort of stuff, whereas this time it's much more under the hood. And I completely agree with Misha in as much as I think it's an upgrade that is at least as exciting as we've seen in the past, despite the fact that it's all under the hood stuff. But that's because I'm a geek and I can see all that stuff that's there. But I think for, you know, Joe Public, it's a tougher sell. I have to say, I don't like the stuff that Apple was doing with them, taking the piss out of Microsoft, calling Windows 7 just another version of Vista, because that's really dodgy ground. A, because I think it's petty and silly and Apple fanboyish, and more importantly, because I think Snow Leopard is just an evolution of Leopard, and calling another OS a mere evolution is really shaky ground when that's exactly what you're doing yourself.
Yeah, but keep in mind, Chris, I mean, this was at the developer conference, so Apple's pandering to the fanboys. You know, whether they take that line with their actual mainstream advertisements, you know, I guess we'll see. You know, that remark elicited a lot of laughter from the crowd, and I think that's all Apple was really going for there.
Well, you can...
Boom! Okay. Shut up!
I will... I will accept you taking giving them the benefit of the doubt there, Misha.
All right, let's move right on next. Let's stop where we are here because we could go on forever about that. And let's move on to the iPhone and the new model, the 3GS. And this is exactly what everyone was hoping for, an upgrade to iPhones. Basically now three models, the existing 8-gigabyte model, which will sell for a cheaper price, and then the iPhone 3GS, for S standing for speed, that will have both a 16 gig model as well as a 32 gig. And let's get right into pricing here, which you know very well on your end, Chris. Here in the U.S., the phone will sell for $199 for the 16 gig version, $299 for the 32 gig version, $99 for the original 3G, and all this pricing is on a 2-year contract. Those with an existing contract already will have to pay a full price of anywhere from $499 up to $699. They might get a little bit of a cheaper price if they've been in their plan at least 6 months. And it's a little bit as complicated in the UK with O2. So explain all this if you can easily or as simply as you can, Chris.
Yeah, I'm not going to try and explain all the different pricing tiers you can do on the podcast because it's too complicated. Have a look at the O2.co.uk site. Basically, as you'd expect from a mobile phone, it's on a sliding scale. So the more you're paying for your monthly contract, the less you pay up front for the hardware device. In fact, you can get the 16 gig iPhone 3GS 16 gig for nothing, for free, if you're paying £75 a month contract. So sliding scale, and there are different pricings depending on whether you commit to an 18-month or a 24-month contract. The same thing exists, though, as in the US, and as much as if you want to upgrade and you have an existing iPhone 3G or indeed an existing iPhone, you're going to have to buy out your existing contract. You pay a termination fee, which is in effect equal to your monthly tariff multiplied by the number of months still left in your contract.
So those who are coming in under a new plan, who don't come from an existing plan, the phone is going to cost what? From what range?
It can be from free all the way up to £275 for a contract. There's also pay-as-you-go pricing. So the 16 gig 3GS is £440.40, and the 32 gig model is £538. So chunky prices there for the pay-as-you-go models.
Right, exactly. And more importantly, in the UK, O2 is offering an 18-month contract as well as a 24-month. Obviously, the 24-month, a little bit cheaper. You get more minutes. And basically, in the 18-month plan, you have four different tariffs. In the 24-month plan, you have three. And as Chris said, it gets a little bit complicated. It's better to look at the website. But for those coming from an existing plan, it really is a big question mark as to whether or not it is worth upgrading, because now the phone price is subsidized where it wasn't before.
Well, the last time you bought, if you bought an original iPhone, you basically paid for the hardware. It wasn't a subsidized handset. The second time with the iPhone 3G, you bought a subsidized handset. So, i.e., O2 was taking on some of the cost of buying that from Apple and passing it on to you as savings. So you paid less upfront with the assumption that you were signing an 18-month contract and you'd be paying for that phone effectively over the life of that contract. In fact, I spoke to O2 just before we came together for this podcast, and the wholesale price that O2 is paying for the new handsets is the same as what they were before in pounds. So it's not as if a lot of people have been complaining that the prices have gone up in the UK. That's an unfair comparison. A, because people are comparing it with 24-month contracts for AT&T in the US. B, because it's the UK-US thing with price differentials and lack of tax for the US pricing and, you know, exchange rates. And C, because the actual wholesale price for the iPhone 3G has 3GS has remained the same as far as O2 is concerned from Apple. You have to buy out your contract, so there is a fair amount of cost involved. Let's say you are an existing iPhone 3G customer, you bought it on the day it was launched, you still got 7 months to go in your contract, so you have to pay £245 to get out of your existing contract, plus the cost of the new phone and the new contract as well.
Misha, let me ask you, whether it's U.S. or U.K., do you believe because of these higher prices for those already in existing plans that Apple is going to miss out on a huge number of sales and upgrades because of this?
Yeah, I mean, I think they'll invariably miss out on some, you know, at the front end. I mean, there's going to be people who bought an iPhone 3G recently, want the 3GS, don't want to pay the higher price. So presumably they're going to buy that phone in a year or whenever their contract's up. So I think over the life of the product, they're not going to lose any sales. But, you know, what people need to keep in mind is that at the end of the day, the iPhone is just a phone. I know we like to think of it as so much more, and maybe it is. But the idea of subsidized handsets and contracts, like, this has been going on for years. This shouldn't be an issue.
I completely agree with Misha. It really annoys me. We've seen a lot of people starting petitions and, you know, flaming O2 for these pricing, and flaming AT&T as well in the States for the pricing and stuff. But it's like, you know, you can criticize the system if you want to, but this is the system. You signed up to an 18-month contract or a 24-month contract. You shouldn't be surprised when there are fees to pay to break that contract.
Right. I mean, you effectively got an iPhone for a lot less money than an iPod Touch would. And you got that because you agreed to the terms of that contract. So if you don't like it, you know, they're not saying you can't buy one.
Right.
They're just saying, okay, you're going to have to pay the penalty for getting out of your contract because you shouldn't have, you know, paid what you did for that phone initially.
And let's not forget as well, I know we're going to come on to talk about the iPhone 3 OS in a sec, but let's not forget that if you've got an iPhone 3G currently, you will, on the 17th of June, be able to download iPhone 3.0, which will give you all but a very, very few features of the iPhone 3GS. So the things you'll miss out on are the better camera with video recording abilities and the voiceover control, a slightly faster processor and you know, the speed increases that brings. But in terms of features, you know, you'll get them, guys. You know, it's okay. The one thing you'll have to pay for extra if you want it is the tethering. Now, the tethering is where you use your iPhone as a modem from your laptop over Bluetooth or over a wire connection. In the States, you poor schmucks over there, you know, AT&T is not even doing it yet. In the UK, pricing has been announced. It's quite expensive. It's £15 a month for an extra 3 gig of data, or 30 quid a month for 10 gig of data. Now, these are quite high prices. I'm not denying that. But, you know, that's the market we're in. You got to pay them if you want to pay them.
I was just going to say, you know, the other feature that 3G owners are missing out on that the 3GS has is the compass, which maybe they need in order to find their way through their phone contract.
Very good point. Very good point. Now,
looking for a magnetic needle in a haystack.
Exactly. Now, let's get into tethering and picture messaging, or what they call MMS. For once, those customers in the UK are going to get something that in the US we're going to be waiting for longer, probably later this summer from AT&T. For some reason, AT&T has decided that they don't want to roll out these two features or even pricing for these two features right now. And as you said, Chris, tethering is going to be £15 for 3 gigs, £30 for 10 gigs, kind of expensive. On picture messaging, we're looking at four different bolt-on packages starting at £12 for messaging for 400 UK messaging units, £10 for 200, that kind of thing. Very interesting how this pricing structure is working in the UK. And Chris, you have an iPhone. Are you even interested in tethering or in MMS messaging?
I am. It's interesting to see it happen. The thing with tethering as well, I think the assumption is there that because you've got unlimited data on your iPhone, you should have unlimited data on tethering as well. But let's not confuse these things altogether. iPhone users aren't special in the way that they maybe think they are. You know, this is just a handset on a network, and the network has standard policies in place for how these things are priced. I spoke to O2. They said that in general, people on the desktop using tethering systems or using modem dongles use 30 times more data than on an iPhone. And we know that the iPhone is a very heavy data user as a handset. And bear in mind that you tend to do things slightly differently. For example, with the terms of service in the UK for the iPhone, you may not stream continuous media onto your iPhone because it's at unlimited data, but because with the tethering plans it's a fixed data cap, you can do whatever you want. So there's a different usage scenario in there as well. MMS, I'm not on a personal level particularly bothered about. It's good to see it. It's 25 pence, I think, a message, unless you sign on to one of those bolt-on packs that Bad was talking about. But, you know, it's good to see it there. A lot of people have been clamoring for it and using it as a reason to denigrate the iPhone.
Misha, what really gets me here with MMS and also with tethering and with AT&T not offering it right now is that this is the premier phone product that AT&T has. They've known for months that Apple was going to come out with these technologies and these services that they needed to offer, and they don't say a thing after the announcement. I mean, we're paying premium money for this phone, and AT&T can't even offer us two of the major features or services that this phone offers. I mean, I personally think that that's embarrassing if I was AT&T.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, the phone, you know, I don't think the iPhone's especially more expensive than other premium smartphones that have tethering. I don't think that this was a willing choice on, you know, AT&T's part. They missed out on a lot of, you know, on capitalizing on the announcement publicity. They were embarrassed a few times by Scott Forstall on stage. And I mean, let's face it, they're leaving money on the table. Why they don't have their act together, I don't know. I think in a couple months when they do, you know, it'll be water under the bridge.
Yeah, very good point. As time goes by, things really leave people's minds. All right, now the phone itself, we kind of quickly got into the pricing, so we overlooked the main features of the phone, some of them that were quite interesting. Video capture, voice control, built-in support for Nike Plus accessories, hardware encryption for exchange users that many people are very excited about on the corporate side, and improved battery life. The phone will be available on June 19th. Chris, let me begin with you. What stood out for you in terms of these new hardware features on the phone, or software features, although we'll get into the OS in a minute?
The thing that really stood out for me was the video recording. It annoyed me that we're not going to get that for existing iPhone 3G customers in the OS 3.0 upgrade. But we suspect that's just because the hardware isn't up to it. Even though folks who've jailbroken their phones using the Sycorder app have been able to get pretty reasonable performance from it. But that's a really useful little thing. There are much better video cameras out there, I'm sure, and even devices like the ones I reviewed in the compact DV cameras last issue do high definition, where this won't. But it's that classic quote, and I forget who said it to me, it might have been Steve Kaplan, said to me, you know, the best camera is the one you have with you. And that's so true of the video capture. There might be better video cameras out there, but if you've got your iPhone with you, as you always will have, you've got a video camera with you, and there'll be some cool stuff there. The fact you can do the video editing as well is really sweet for that.
And you, Misha, what did you see as the 3GS's biggest features that you liked?
For me, the speed. I mean, once you get a lot of apps on your iPhone, and I have still the first generation iPhone, things start getting really slow. Just quitting apps, the responsiveness of the touches. When I was watching the WWDC keynote, I noticed how quickly everything was operating on that phone. How quickly, you know, just how much faster screens were popping up, the phone was processing stuff. So that's what I'm looking forward to, because that's, again, what you use all the time. That's why Snow Leopard is cool to me. That's why the iPhone 3GS is cool to me. The camera's pretty nifty, too. I mean, what I like is that more so than the capabilities is the fact that Apple isn't embarrassing itself anymore. 2-megapixel camera in the iPhone was 3 years ago technology.
What's even worse about the camera that's in there is not the fact that it's 2 megapixels per se, because we all know megapixels don't really mean that much, but the fact that it was a very bad sensor, it was a fixed focus lens, it was, you know, there was no sophistication to that camera and to its sensor at all.
Right, and now they've got this 3.2 megapixel autofocus sensor, which is sort of industry standard among all high-end phones. I mean, Nokia's using it, RIM's using it in their Blackberries. So at least now, you know, there isn't this asterisk when you're telling someone why an iPhone's so good that, oh yeah, but the camera's not great. Mm-hmm. So that's cool. And frankly, the other feature I like a lot is the compass, because I do travel a lot, and the iPhone Maps application is invaluable when you're in a city that you don't know, but it's still not perfect when you jump out of a, you know, tube stop and you're not sure which way you're facing, and then you end up walking a block in the wrong direction because you thought you were going north, but you're actually going south.
Yeah, I completely agree.
So that'll be great.
Yeah, I completely agree. The other really cool thing on that sort of navigation topic that you're raising there was the fact that we had TomTom demoing a full 3G, a full GPS solution with turn-by-turn directions, the whole ball of wax with a, you know, a cradle for charging your iPhone as it does it, as a software package for the iPhone, and we think for the iPhone 3G as well. That's really, really cool, because I love TomTom. I think it's a really good system, and seeing the ability just to plop that onto your iPhone and have a full GPS for your car is sensational. I love that.
And we'll have to wait for pricing on that from TomTom a little bit later on this year. Let's hear from Phil Schiller now with some features of the new iPhone 3GS.
This is the most powerful, fastest iPhone we've ever made. It has the same great design of the iPhone 3G that we just launched last summer, but what's inside is entirely new. This is a really fast iPhone. Everything you do all day long, you'll find incredible speed ups. For example, something as simple as launching a messaging application, 2.1 times faster. Loading a game like SimCity, 2.4 times faster. Viewing attachments and emails like an Excel attachment, 3.6 times faster. going to a graphically intense JavaScript website like the New York Times, 2.9 times faster. Now, these are all speeds against an iPhone 3G running the still-to-be-released 3.0 software, so we really made sure it was against the highest benchmark. It's a really fast phone. It also has amazing features. For example, there's a brand-new built-in camera, 3-megapixel autofocus camera. It has amazing hardware and software that work together, as Apple is known to do. We make these things work hand-in-hand, and this has autofocus, auto-white balance, auto-exposure to take just a gorgeous photo for you. In addition to autofocus, we've got a great feature called tap to focus. So if I'm composing my photo, for example, in this case, I want a photo that focuses on the house, I just tap the house and it's in focus, and we balance the exposure for that. If I want to take a picture of the flower, I just tap it, and now it's in focus, and the photo's balanced as well.
And from the iPhone 3GS, let's move on finally to the iPhone 3.0 OS. We knew a number of new features were coming for the OS. 100 new features is the list that Apple gave at the developers conference as well as online. Lots of new ideas. Find My iPhone, which will locate a lost or stolen device. If it's turned on, that's the real key here. A number of other new features in the addition of Spotlight that will enable users to search not only their contacts, but also calendar entries, notes, email, even apps for the iPhone, for the device itself. Cut and paste, which we knew was coming. Chris, what stands out for you that we didn't already know about in the OS update?
The one thing that we didn't know about that was quite cool was that Find It For Me, Find My Phone thing that you're talking about, which I think requires a Mobile Me membership. But you can send messages to your iPhone to display on the screen if it's on, so that if you think you've lost it and you suddenly remember where it is, or you use the Find My iPhone thing to locate it, you can put a message up on the screen saying, oh, I've left this here, I'm coming to get it, please stay open until 5, I'll give you a tenner or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, you can push messages to it as well. That's quite cool. But in terms of stuff we already knew that was coming, I think for me the big thing is Spotlight search, the ability to actually do some proper searching on this, including for email, because currently the inability to search email is a real bugbear of mine. There's stuff in there that I know people have been just yelling for months, MMS, the copy and paste, the landscape keyboard. Frankly, these are things that I've never really desperately needed. The landscape keyboard, I think, is a bit pointless, because honestly, I think if you're using the keyboard properly, and I think very few people do, then it works fine in portrait mode. But there are certainly some cool things in there.
And Misha, one of the things that really stood out for me, and I'm wondering where you, if you agree with how important this is and maybe where we're going with it, is the ability now to purchase and rent movies, TV shows, music videos, audiobooks from inside the phone's iTunes app. And I think this is really going to be something big. And I wonder if the next move for Apple in this area is then going to be for not only the phone, but for desktop Macs as well, the ability to download software directly and buy online.
Well, this is just an extension of what Apple's been doing all along, which is slowly bringing more and more features that you get in iTunes and from the iTunes store on your Mac to your phone. I'm not too sure whether a lot of people will be able to download a movie before they hop on a plane, as I think Phil Schiller said. I don't know, you know, what people's internet connections are like, but I think this idea that you can just grab a film in like 5 minutes is going to disappoint a lot of people. And it'll be interesting to see how Apple handles that. You know, do they charge you up front? Do they charge you when it's done? Can you resume the download? I mean, I'm sure they've got something figured out that's great and makes sense. The more interesting thing in my mind is the new in-app purchasing features, which allow someone to buy an application and then later on add additional features or levels or other things to that they didn't get originally for an additional price. Obviously, you know, games, this is an obvious segment. You can buy more levels, you can buy more weapons or more cars or whatnot. I think it'll also have applications in other realms, like, you know, TomTom with their GPS. I mean, you could go to a country or to a city that you don't have the map for and download it on the go for a price, which I think is pretty interesting. And I think, you know, more than anything else, developers are going to find clever ways to leverage this, where, you know, there no longer will be this divide between a $1 app and a $20 app, because you'll be able to buy the $20 app for only a dollar, and as you want more features, pay for them.
Yeah, very good point. Your thoughts on that, Chris?
Yeah, I think there's going to be absolutely immense. And I think the other thing that's not really a customer-facing feature at this point, but that we know about from the SDK presentation, is the fact that the iPhone with the OS 3.0 installed will be able to control hardware through its dock connector as well. And I can't even begin to put into words how phenomenally, massively huge this is going to be. And the hardware add-ons that people are going to develop for the iPhone are going to be sensational. And I already think it's phenomenal how, with the addition of a free or a $2 app, you can transform the iPhone into something completely different. I think with the addition of hardware, sleds and dongles and add-ons and all that sort of stuff, it's just going to make it even more impressive. There's that old adage, isn't there, in computer circles, that you never buy a 1.0, and it's only with the 3.0 that it actually becomes the device that the developer had always intended it to be. And I think that's certainly true with the iPhone OS 3.0. Things like cut, copy and paste and the MMS and the search, all that sort of stuff is very much, I think, that was on Apple's original checklist for what they wanted the iPhone to be, but it's just taken them this few little whiles to get there. But, you know, I love the fact they brought it out, it was good to begin with, and it's only got better. How many other phones on the market, even smartphones, even Windows Mobile or Symbian phones, do you add features to for free over the years? I can't really think of any.
Well, look, the big feature that's missing in the iPhone is multitasking. And that's the feature that the Palm Pre has. And when you've seen the demos of the Palm Pre, or if you've used one yourself, you realize how handy this is. Because right now in the iPhone, if I'm on a website and I see something interesting, I mean, Apple's sort of bridging this gap with cut, copy, and paste, but it's really difficult for me to take something in Safari, copy it, turn it into a calendar invitation, and then email that new event. Like, simply, like, you can't do it. Or if you can sort of do it with cut, copy, and paste, it's going to require quitting Safari, then loading the calendar, then quitting the calendar, then loading the Mail app. And multitasking really takes, like, the versatility that you enjoy on your desktop computer and puts it on the phone, so that with a Palm Pre, you can be switching between these concurrently. You can have your calendar open and your email open and literally just swipe your finger and switch between the two. You don't have to wait for one to quit and the other to open. I think the reason why we don't see that in the iPhone OS right now is because Apple's very clear about wanting iPhone OS 3.0 to run on all the hardware. And frankly, I don't think the processor in the 3G or the first generation iPhone can handle multitasking. And they also have half the RAM of the new one. So I think what we might see is an iPhone OS 3.1 or 3.5 or 4.0, when Apple starts to decide, okay, you know, these first generation iPhones, they're starting to get old, everyone's replacing them anyway. I think when Apple's comfortable offering an upgrade path that makes sense, we'll see those additional features. But to me, that's the biggest omission to the iPhone, and that's the biggest marketing point that the Palm Pre has going for it right now.
Yeah, but how long can Apple wait to not do that, Misha?
I think we'll probably see it in a year. I mean, I know that Apple is planning on rolling out these Dotto releases every year. You know, they're going to do a new phone every year.
Yeah, but is that too long, Chris?
No, I don't think that's too long. To be honest, I think I completely take Misha's point. I know that people who've used the Palm Pre, and I wish I was one of them, but I'm not. People who've used it say that that multitasking thing does make you feel like you're using a computer much more than you're using a phone, in a good way, because it's much more fluid, it's much more sort of tied together than it is using the iPhone. Although Apple's counter-argument to that, I'm sure, would be that the speed of the iPhone 3GS mitigates a lot of that opening and quitting stuff that Misha was talking about. But it's that thing about what the geeks care about and what the public care about. I think most people, if you told my mum that her phone wasn't capable of multitasking, she wouldn't know what I was talking about, and she wouldn't care, and nor should she in a lot of cases. It depends how much of a heavy user you are. So in terms of timescales, I don't think that's a dreadful problem for Apple. And I think Misha's right to say that in 2010, we'll start to see some divisions, some lines in the sand being drawn.
And between the models.
Off, yeah, exactly, and dropping off some support for the older models then.
I mean, look at it this way. When the first iPhone came out and it had that terrible 2-megapixel sensor camera and it was only on Edge when everyone was expecting it to be on 3G, that didn't seem to hurt its success. I mean, I think Apple realizes that they've probably got a window of 1 to 2 years before consumers catch up with what other people are doing and start to get annoyed by where, you know, Apple is at.
All right, very good point. Let's end this whole thing with a negative, and that is, now we've gone totally on laptops to a sealed battery. I think it's really dumb.
Well, there are pros and cons, aren't there? Because obviously by doing a sealed battery, you've got a bit more space to put the battery into, so you do get a longer battery life. Me, personally, I'm much prefer my existing MacBook Pro with a removable battery because I like having that flexibility. But I know that for a lot of people, it's not really that important.
Where do you stand on this, Misha?
I think Apple looked at the numbers and saw that most people only ever buy one battery for their laptop. If you're only buying one battery, then this is a huge boon for you to get twice the battery life, to have a battery that you don't need to replace, you know, after 1 or 2 years. But I think anybody that flies across the ocean is not going to like the limitation on that sealed battery. Having said that, there have been in the last month or two third-party companies that are releasing external battery packs.
Right.
For all of Apple's laptops. They just plug in through the MagSafe connector. So I think that mitigates a lot of the problems. I think Apple would do itself a favor by releasing its own Apple-branded external battery pack that looks sexy, that people can buy with their Mac, and that probably costs way more than it should. But there are, you know, slowly the market's catching up as far as identifying that, you know, this is an area for which there ought to be a solution. I mean, it started a year ago with the MacBook Air, and then, you know, the 17-inch MacBook Pro has been out for a while. But I have to say, I have friends who have the new 17-inch MacBook Pro. They were hesitant about the sealed battery, and they've sort of come back to me and said, you know, it's actually not a problem. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm really actually getting 7 hours of real-world use, and it's rare that I use my computer for 7 hours straight and I'm not near a power source. Look, it's a question of trade-offs.
Yeah, I'm kind of with Misha on that one. But Brad, you said you thought it was a dumb idea.
Yeah, I just think for those who are really traveling a lot, you know, you're going to need that battery. And why take it out unless it's something to save Apple money? And to me, that's what they're doing. Plus the ability to charge people and gouge people more for a battery upgrade in 6 or 7 years. Yes, maybe their numbers prove that people replace their laptops a lot sooner than that. That's not the point. To me, this is a way to gouge people for more money to buy another battery they have to replace or to buy another third-party battery.
Ah, you're a big old conspiracy theorist there, Brad.
I think let's
just make sure we've got this clear. One of the reasons, and I'm not saying that cost saving isn't one of them, but one of the reasons that you would have a sealed battery, and this is one of the reasons that Apple talks about, is that by not being constrained to a block size, by not be having to put external plastics and latches and all that sort of stuff around it, you can actually use much more of that internal space to fill up, to almost like pouring in battery, if you will. Like imagine it as a liquid, to like sort of fill up that space so you get more capacity, and that's indeed what Apple has done. And you know, as Misha says, you do actually get, you know, reasonable 6-7 hour from 17 inch at least, because that's got a huge battery in it. You get reasonable 6-7 hour real world battery life from these things because the battery is that much bigger. So I'm not saying cost saving isn't part of it, but I think that there are definite real practical benefits as well as far as the user's concerned.
I don't think this is a ploy by Apple to make a little bit of money in 5 years. I mean, they're sitting on like $28 billion in cash. I don't think that they're making a
hit make money
how to
on
get
batteries.
A little bit more money. Will it cost more to replace the sealed battery? Probably. I think they might even have pricing online that says how much more it is. But look at it. Like, this sealed battery lasts, supposedly, the lifespan is 3 times longer. So as long as they're not charging 3 times more, or even if they are charging 3 times more, you're breaking even. If they're charging less than 3 times more, you're actually coming out ahead. And again, I'm not sure what that pricing is, but right now a MacBook Pro battery at retail in the States is $130. And I have a feeling replacing that sealed battery is not going to suddenly cost $500.
It would be nice to have the option. I mean, there are some of us, and I'm one of these people that does want to have the ability of swapping out a battery if I'm covering a trade show or something, because mm-hmm. I want to have that flexibility. But, you know, it'd be nice to have the option, but if we don't have the option, I think the one they've gone for is of more practical benefit to the most users and reflects better the way in which people actually use these devices.
You know, the one thing I wish Apple would give is the option to drop that SuperDrive from the MacBook Pro. I mean, they convince everyone with the Air that you probably don't need it. I know I seldom use mine, and I would rather have that either filled with an even larger battery or a second hard drive. So that would be the one thing, you know, battery-wise, like, give me the sealed battery, take out the SuperDrive, give me another 2-3 hours, and I'm perfectly pleased.
And that's such a brilliant idea, Misha, that I just want to make sure people know that there is actually a third-party company, at least in the States, and I believe they don't do international shipping, but at least in the States, there's a company called MCE that will swap out your SuperDrive for a second internal hard drive, and obviously you could raid those up and have, you know, automatic backup happening, all that sort of stuff. So there is that option. It's a good idea, and you're right, I wish Apple would offer it as an option themselves. But if you have an existing MacBook or MacBook Pro, you can pay MCE to swap out your SuperDrive for you.
Very good point. Okay, notebooks, Snow Leopard, iPhone 3GS, iPhone 3.0 OS, all new announcements or things we knew were coming that are finally here, announced at the recent WWDC conference in San Francisco. Misha, Chris, thanks so much for going over these announcements. We'll see you soon. Thanks so much.
See you, Brad.
Thanks, Brad.
Cheers.
Misha Sakharopoulos, the associate producer of Mac Format This Week. Chris Finn is the deputy editor of Mac Format Magazine. And that's it for another edition of Mac Format This Week. My thanks to Chris Finn and our associate producer, Misha Sakharopoulos. And for our U.S. listeners, don't forget you can subscribe to the U.K.'s number one Mac magazine each and every month. Just go to www.imsnews.com/macformat or by clicking on the Enhanced Podcast link now and entering the promo code 2003. And we'll be back with our regular edition of features, reviews, and Q&A on Monday, the 29th of June. Until then, I'm Brad Gibson. Thanks for joining us.